So you're a former Canadian diplomat, a professor emeritus of English at Berkeley, and as well as a prolific writer on politics and poetry. Is there anything we can add to your background?
No, it's about it, I think.
I wanted just to start off on the topic of education and teaching at university. When you were a diplomat, did you witness any deep politics events?
I don't think I so much witnessed one, but one of my friends were in Warsaw when I was a junior diplomat in the Canadian embassy. I knew the first secretary in the Argentine embassy, and he had an infant boy, about 6 months, very sweet, dear little boy. And about 30 years later, he was a convicted drug trafficker pilot who testified in the trial against Manuel Noriega. So he had grown up to be a drug trafficker himself. But as I say, when I witnessed him, he was 6 months old and a baby. So I don't think I've got much closer to the drug traffic than that, personally.
And so where and how did you turn sort of into this way of thinking?
Well, that's a good question. I was in Warsaw. One of my responsibilities was to keep track of the cable traffic on Indochina because Poland and Canada served with India on the Control Commission. So I saw a great many cables about Laos in that period, 59 to 61. I didn't remember any of them. But when I came to Berkeley and it became obvious that America was edging towards involvement in Vietnam, I got interested in Vietnam and was I started writing and speaking and debating against American involvement in the Vietnam War. And then when President Kennedy was assassinated, and we learned later that a crucial commitment to win in Vietnam was made by Johnson before Oswald was dead, even within 48 hours of Kennedy's death. That got me interested in the Kennedy assassination. And there are drug aspects to the Kennedy assassination and also to the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia. It was drugs were almost a common denominator to the two stories. So my first book, The War Conspiracy, ended with a chapter about the drug trade in Southeast Asia. And I've been writing, that was in 1972, which is, you know, a quarter century ago, and I've been writing about it ever since. So it was Vietnam and then the Kennedy assassination and then drugs.
Right. You mentioned in your writing, which we'll talk about a little bit later, E. Howard Hunt, and how he was involved in the drug running, and I believe he had a deathbed confession that he was involved in the JFK assassination.
That's correct? Right. I'm not sure I really believe his deathbed confession. I do think he was involved in a sense, but he and a man called David Phillips, who was in the U.S. CIA station in Mexico City, that their job was to sort of distract people and draw attention to themselves so that people would not be looking at other aspects of the CIA story. But yes, he was definitely involved in drugs. And of course, that was another thing. I became involved in Watergate because I wrote a manuscript never published about the Kennedy assassination. And I focused on a man called Frank Fiorini or Frank Sturgis, who was also accused of being involved with more casinos than drugs, but the mafia scene in Cuba. And my book came out in the very same week. I was very astonished to see his photograph on the front page of the New York Times, along with Howard Hunt. The two men had just been arrested for their involvement in the Watergate break-in. So that got me interested not just in the Kennedy assassination, but also in Watergate, the links between them. And I've recently been writing quite a lot about what I call deep events, in which events we never get to the bottom of, like the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, and most recently 9/11. And I have suggested quite a few times, that those deep events are treated as accidents in the press, but are actually part of the way that our history is controlled, and that drugs is a factor in every one of those deep events. I didn't mention Iran-Contra, but drugs was really quite central to what happened in Iran-Contra in the 1980s.
Since you were on that topic, I thought just to bring up Martin Luther King. It wasn't until recently that I discovered the court case from 1999 of the King family, which came out with the final verdict that agencies of the U.S. government were involved with his assassination, correct?
Yes, that was the verdict, the court verdict, and it's been disputed. But I think what is not disputed is that the alleged assassin, who I don't think was an assassin, James Earl Ray, he had been to Mexico under circumstances that looked as if he might have been carrying drugs for some mafia figures in Louisiana. So, yes, there is a drug aspect to that killing as well. In fact, it's never been published, but I gave a talk once about the common denominators in the Kennedy assassin. John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, all three of them have leads which suggest the involvement of government agencies, particularly in the cover-up, but even before, and once again, the drug traffic.
To finish off on that topic of education, you mentioned to me how perhaps your material and similar material might not, it wouldn't be allowed to be taught at U.S. universities.
Well,
any comment?
I think now it's the Kennedy assassination, there are courses on it, but 9/11 is very sensitive. I was retired when I wrote my book about 9/11, The Road to 9/11. Edited an anthology with David Ray Griffin, and we published an article by another university professor, Stephen Jones, about how the buildings came down and the presence of nanothermite in the dust, suggesting that there had been internal explosions to demolish the buildings. And he lost his job at the university for that. And I published an early article in a university magazine here. I again was retired, but the editor of the magazine lost his job right after he published this article by me. So 9/11 is extremely sensitive right now. I don't know whether you know it, but both the State Department and the White House have officers whose job it is to combat the theory that there was any other explanation than the official explanation for either the Kennedy assassination or 9/11.
Was that a recent development? Because I heard in the news some weeks ago that the Department of Homeland Security was infiltrating higher education.
Oh, I think I know the story you're talking about, that they were coordinating with universities on how to deal with Occupy protests. I don't think they were trying to interfere with, as far as I know, with the content of education, but they definitely were very sensitive to the student opinion on the campuses. You know, it's a received idea in the Pentagon. Oliver North testified to it back in Iran-Contra, that the United States really lost the war in Vietnam because of public opinion in America. And the Pentagon has gone to great lengths to make sure that there will never be another student protest movement, anti-war movement, now in the era of Afghanistan, the way there was back then in the era of Vietnam. So that's where I think the Homeland Security has been involved.
You mentioned how the war machine embraces universities. Do you think it important? I certainly do, that students and perhaps professors continue to push to question these the revised history, let's say, that we are given.
Oh, for me, I think it's essential to the health of if you're going to have a free society, you have to know what how your history develops. And as I say, I believe that, well, it's actually not very hard to prove in the case of 9/11. This had a profound effect on American government and history. Essentially, there are aspects of the Constitution which have been waived, like habeas corpus and the Fourth Amendment against invasion of privacy. And I think that 9/11 happened partly so that the government could be changed. There have been people planning for 2 decades for what was called it. There were questions again at the time of Iran-Contra about this, a so-called emergency planning, or they call it continuity of government planning. It was very secret. The name for it in the Pentagon, it was also very big. It was a $1 billion budget, and it was called the Doomsday Project. And those people were planning for 20 years to make the changes that were actually introduced on September the 11th, 2001, before the fourth plane had hit the ground. They had instituted what they call COG, Continuity of Government. And we don't know what all of it was, but we know what the plans were back in the 1987, and they were what happened. They were warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention, and the militarization of government. We now live in a military district in America. All of this is very new, and as a result of a deep event, 9/11. So yes, your question was, should these things be studied? If we don't study these things, we don't know how our government is being shaped and controlled. So I think it's vital.
When you say it's a military district or a police state, one personal example is when I studied international relations abroad in a school of diplomacy, and my sister studied with me as well, and she went to take the examinations to be a foreign service officer, and she passed 2 of the examinations, and she was about to go off to Washington for the final examination, and they abruptly told her that she was disqualified because they told her and or members of her family were considered disloyal citizens of the United States.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. Actually, some of the very strong critics of what's happening in America now are people who were once in the government, even in the CIA. There's a man called Ray McGovern. I know him. He's a friend. He was a very senior analyst in the CIA. He actually prepared the daily reports that were read by the president in the White House, and that's about as high as you can get. And he is so appalled. That's what has happened recently with the drone attacks and the torture and all. I didn't even mention that before, but can you imagine America? I mean, I've lived 50 years in America. If you had told me 50 years ago there would be a time that America would not only condone torture but would actually use it as a means of dealing with its enemies, I wouldn't have believed you. But these are these incredible things that have happened recently.
Just to remind students that they can jump in at any time, and as well as have any critical questions for you. What is the biggest criticism that you've received, perhaps, for your work?
Oh, I feel I've been very well treated. You know, I've been in other countries. I wouldn't do in China, for example, or Russia exactly what I do here. And those are, by the way, I admire both those countries, but they certainly don't give as much freedom of criticism as America does. I've seen other people lose their jobs, and that never happened to me. Even the University Press published my book on the road to 9/11, which is really quite remarkable. I think it's the only University Press that has published a book on 9/11. But then I submitted American War Machine. The book that I'm working on now, I submitted to them, and I got the impression that they had used up, that they couldn't risk doing another book by me, that I had become too controversial. But that's a very minor complaint, you know. Essentially, I would look to myself as an example that America is still a much more tolerant society than the average superstate.
Which book was it of yours, I think, that you mentioned that where the publisher didn't want to publish it and they tried to find something wrong with it and they went through like 1,000 of your footnotes and could not find one wrong citation?
That's a book that never appeared back. That was about the Kennedy assassination back in 1979. It was actually announced in the spring catalog of a major U.S. publishing house with a photograph of it. It was all ready to go. I mean, the photographs, everything had been done. And in the end, they just didn't publish it. And they actually, about 5 years later, they asked for the advance back. Well, I had spent the whole advance, a lot of it on answering the legal questions. And I said, I'm not litigious, but if you sue me, I will countersue and I will win, because they were the ones who broke the contract, clearly. And then they phoned later and said, well, we understand there were some legal problems. And I said, name me one. And then eventually I didn't hear from them. Yes, there are things, a lot of things I could complain about, but my big point is they're very minor things, you know. So it wasn't a terribly good book anyway, the one that was not published.
If we could then get into some of the material in your book and deep politics. It seems like many of the students here are more aware of these truths, such as CIA drug running, but it seems like they lack the proper terminology to analyze these things and express them. And you've put it out very well, deep state, deep force violence, parapolitics. Perhaps if you can just discuss those definitions briefly.
I came up with the idea of parapolitics to describe all the events that the covert operations of the CIA, that they were not accounted. If they conducted an operation, it should be, this is a quote, plausibly deniable. And I said these, I now call them deep events, but these examples of parapolitics are affecting the world much more seriously than most people realized. I think back then people had less awareness than they do now. I mean, I did all this before the CIA involvement in Chile, for example, where they helped overthrow one of the most democratic governments in Latin America. That happened after I'd come up with the context. Now I talk about deep politics, because some deep political events are parapolitical in the sense that they are connivances, things that have been contrived by intelligence agencies, but some are just things that happen. I mean, like the whole of the drug traffic, for example, we hear very little about it in the newspapers except when they arrest somebody. We don't understand who the major movers are, although it's clear that there are billionaires in the world who enjoy protection from one government or another and who seriously affect the politics of, say, Pakistan or Lebanon. And you just don't hear about them. So deep politics is a larger concept than parapolitics. And then there's the concept of a deep event, which is anything that happens and we don't understand it. And there may even be an investigation of it, but we know the investigation is not going to get to the bottom of it. I welcomed the 9/11 Commission, not because I thought that they would get to the bottom of the case, but it would force the government to put its own version of events in writing And then critics could go to work and show what was wrong. It's exactly what happened with the Warren Commission and the Kennedy assassination. The Warren Report was very useful in that respect also.
You mentioned our reluctance to think of some of these things, and I've always been a believer that we won't get to the bottom of anything or change anything unless we talk exactly about these things. And you call it a great conspiracy of organized denial, or perhaps another term might be cognitive dissonance. And I recall when I was a grad student, a friend and I gave a great presentation, and we mentioned 9/11, and it was around the time that nanothermite scientific article came out. And we cited that as our source because it was, like you say, I think the evidence is there. And our professor was a psychology professor. And he decided he asked us to have coffee, my friend and me, and no other students in the class. And we realized later what he was actually doing was psycho-evaluating us during that coffee we had with him.
No, officially, we're all supposed to have something wrong with us that we would do something as crazy as be conspiracy theorists. I know, as I say, there's an officer in the State Department, and initially he was saying the same things about what was wrong with, and there's a man, Cass Sunstein, he's now a director of information in Obama's White House, and before he went into the White House, this is when Bush was still president, he wrote an article. He was a Harvard professor at the time, saying that these conspiracy theorists are such twisted personalities that they're dangerous, and that there should be organized what he called cognitive infiltration of their movement, which sounds like this is what the FBI does all the time. You know, there's some movement they don't like, so they put somebody inside it ostensibly to gain information, but they then become the provocateurs to make the movement look ridiculous or dangerous. And this was, it's a kind of compliment, I suppose, that they take this criticism, they view this criticism as being so dangerous. I don't know. I mean, we had, I think for a half century, a majority of people have not believed the official version of the Kennedy assassination, but it doesn't seem to have made much difference. And as I did a book about the Kennedy assassination, and I pointed out that a large majority didn't believe the official version, but a majority also believed that it shouldn't be investigated any further. So in other words, they prefer to live with a false picture of how our country is being run than get to the unpleasant facts. Nobody likes to keep unpleasant facts in mind. We all have something, a capacity, a tendency to denial, to suppress what is not pleasant. I start my book, The American War Machine, this one, begins with a personal anecdote about how something, oh, by the way, you asked how close did I get to the drug traffic. I forgot. I repressed, you might say. My brain suppressed this little anecdote, which is perhaps worth telling, that I wrote a book in 71, 72 about the CIA and drugs, and my friend Alfred McCoy did the same thing, and his book is what became a bestseller. And the two of us, I had been on a anti-war platform with a special forces officer from the Vietnam, who had been in Vietnam or in Indochina. And I had heard him say that he had seen drugs being loaded onto planes of Air America, which was the CIA's airline in Indochina. And so Al wanted to interview him on tape for his book. And I phoned from my house in Berkeley to the pilot's house, I mean the soldier's house, who was not far away in Palo Alto. And he said, sure, I'll talk. I don't care. And the next morning, we drove down to his house 50 miles away. And he came out of the door like this and saying, indicating that we shouldn't talk. He guided us down the stairs to his car. And there was his MG, a nice sports car, with a huge hole in the steel door. And now he was talking, and he said, look at that hole, he said. And then he said, now look at the wooden floor. And we looked at the wooden floor. You see, the wooden floor is not even singed. That was an implosive device that blew a hole in the steel door. It was done as a message to me. It was an implosive device. It must have come from my old unit. Well, this was a little bit of terrorism. He had been terrorized into silence, and whoever did it must have had some relationship to the whole idea of drugs being loaded onto CIA planes, and they had access to the content of the telephone call between my house and his house the afternoon before. I do believe, I was quite active in the anti-war movement, I do believe that my phone was tapped a good deal of the time, so it isn't surprising to me that the government would have known what happened in that phone call, but it's a bit shocking that it resulted in an act of illegal violence in Palo Alto. And what is even more shocking, and the whole point of my taking all of your time on this, is here's an unforgettable event which I forgot. I suppressed all memory of it. And then I wrote a poem called Coming to Jakarta, and the whole thing was, the whole poem, it's a book-length poem, is about all the things that I was repressing. And in that poem is the idea that civilization is organized denial. And one of the last memories that I got back in writing the poem was the memory of what happened with this fellow's MG. So then I wrote Al McCoy, and he didn't remember. But when he brought out the next edition of The Politics of Heroin, he puts my poem in the preface as his way of acknowledging that something very strange happened that day that neither of us remembered. Now, I'm sorry to have taken so much time on this personal anecdote, but it really tells us something not only about our society, that this is a dangerous piece of knowledge that drugs were loaded on CIA planes, but it also tells us something about ourselves, that we don't want to remember these unpleasant facts of when we witness violence. You asked me at the beginning, perhaps you were, it was a leading question and you wanted me to tell that anecdote, but I didn't remember it.
Right, I was going to ask you about that. That was fascinating. And just to finish on my note with the professor.
I could ask the classic question. You all sure. You live in Guadalajara, and it's different in Mexico from America in this respect, that you have to deal with the fact of violence in the streets all the time, including quite recently. So does that mean, I mean, do you also try not to think about it, or is it so much thrown in your face that you have to think about it? I wonder about what it would be like to live in those circumstances.
I personally believe that most of us are getting used to it, and like people in general, but as our major, we have it more present when we try to analyze it differently. But as people in Mexico as a general, they are getting used to it. Like it's something they don't see different. It's something they even sometimes they celebrate in some regions.
Can I ask another question? Back in 1968, there was a student protest in Mexico City in the Tlatelolco Square, and it turned into a massacre. Does everybody know about that massacre, or has it been suppressed from the history of Mexico?
We are taught about it in school. And there's a phrase that it's called, it says, 2 de octubre no se olvida, October 2nd, we do not forget. but people know it happened, but they don't know how it was, who did it. And as I told you, mostly people that are interested in politics and are interested in history are the ones that know really what's going on, but not generally.
I'm very interested in that particular episode, partly because the people who organized it, I think we now know, were people connected with the Dirección Federal de Seguridad, which is the center of my article, my chapter on Mexico in this book, American War Machine, but also because a few months later, we had a very similar, well, not very similar, but yes, somewhat similar event on my campus, where students were herded into a big square and then all the exits were blocked. Only they didn't massacre people, they just tried to spray them with tear gas from a helicopter. So it wasn't anything like as bad as the Mexican one. But some of the elements of how the event was put together, and particularly the locking in of students, not letting them escape, was a common denominator between the two events, a deep event again.
Before we look at the DFS, we have a student with another question.
Hello.
Hello.
It's kind of out of topic, but whatever. Do you think a possible legalization of drugs in the U.S., or how do you think it would affect in related to Mexico's drug trafficking problem? You know, if for some reason drugs were legalized in the U.S., do you think it would kind of solve the problem we have in here, or soften it?
I do passionately, yes. I just take the one question of marijuana. If marijuana is to some extent being partially legalized, particularly in California where I live, partial legalization means that there's more drugs being grown, but it's really an invitation to make it easier for the Mexican cartels to come north of the border, and actually they have Mexicans growing drugs we have many forests in California, and they find these huge plantations, thousands of plants that are planted not by Americans, but by Mexicans working for the Mexican cartels. This is a bad situation. I believe that if we were to legalize marijuana, possibly control how it is sold. I mean, when you legalize it, you don't have to, I should say decriminalize it. You don't have to put it out on the free market, but you would take the profits out. And I think that, you know, there's the Mexican cartels are also involved in trafficking cocaine from Colombia and Peru, but that the bulk of their profits is coming from marijuana. And if people in America could grow their own marijuana, that it would not be economically as advantageous to the Mexican cartels to have these huge plantations of marijuana both north of the border and also south of the border. That would take the profits out of it. And if you take the profits out of it, then I think the cartels would not be able to support the gangs, the private armies, in effect, that they have. So, yes, I think that's, I've always said that, you know, in America, people tend to talk about the Mexican drug problem, but it is a problem that was imposed on Mexico by other foreign forces. As I say in my chapter, one was the fact that the Kuomintang, the Chinese nationalists, were supporting their movement with the drug traffic. And another was that America decided to make the traffic illegal in 1914. And the third reason for the drug traffic was all the turmoil in Mexico at the time of the revolution at the same time. But here are three factors. Only one of them was Mexican. And it's the whole, I think, artificial and wrong attitude of the American government that has created a terrible problem for Mexico in the form of competing drug gangs, and that the easiest way to do something about it, you know, there's no ideal solution, but a first step. I don't think it's going to happen because there's too much at stake here, but in theory, the easiest way to do something about it would be to start by legalizing marijuana and take the huge profits out of the marijuana industry, and then you could go on perhaps and deal progressively with controlled decriminalization of cocaine as well. But these are solutions to be found north of the border, and simply fighting a drug war, as President Calderon is doing, is, I think, going to go on forever. It's not going to end at all. And one of the factors that's made things so difficult for Mexico was Nixon declaring a war on drugs back in 1970, which he did for many reasons. I have it's in my book also, as some of the reasons were the ones he gave, which was there is a real drug problem. But that's not the only reason he had. And if you wanted to do something about the drug problem, I would say the first thing to do would be to end the so-called war on drugs, scale back on the DEA. So many of the real deleterious effect of drugs are all the crimes that are committed because of drugs. And now we're seeing in Europe, in Portugal and in the Netherlands, a program of decriminalizing. And the first thing you see is that the crime rate goes way down. There are fewer robberies, there's less prostitution. It's to me shocking that we've had these very obvious results in Europe, and they're essentially lying about it in America because they don't want to cut the budget of the DEA. They were cutting all these budgets, but they don't want to cut the budget of the DEA. We're in a very irrational situation. Huge profits are being made, and I have no doubt that those one reason that we're not getting to a more rational policy is because those huge fortunes are successfully lobbying against it.
Are one of those fortunes the pharmaceutical company? Or what do you think about that? Because I've heard theories that say that some drugs, especially marijuana and I think cocaine, are not legal or are criminalized because of, you know, the huge multinational pharmaceutical companies, because supposedly they would lose like 80% of their income every year if those drugs were legalized. Have you heard any of that?
Yes, I haven't followed that so closely because that's not my specialty, but first of all, the pharmaceutical companies are enormously powerful and have affected Medicare and so on. We have a drug program being paid for by the government, which doesn't make sense. It is true that the drug companies profit by selling their products in the place of the illegalized natural commodities like marijuana. I don't know the statistics myself, but there is that correlation. I've never really understood these are in the areas of things that are not talked about in a coherent way. I spent 6 months in Washington back in at the time of Iran-Contra, and it became very clear to me that you can't talk about these things in Washington. I was actually in a secret hearing and I heard the chairman of the hearing say, I will not allow that word legalization to be used in this hearing. Well, that's not a very rational way to address a very serious topic. Just to forbid discussion of it is a symptom of the irrationality here and the secrecy and the suppression. So when I write against the drug traffic, originally I was hoping it would make a more rational policy. I don't really think I will see that happen in my lifetime now. Of course, I'm 83. It may happen in somebody else's lifetime, in your lifetime, but it's going to be very difficult.
All right. Okay, thank you. And Also, I have just another question. You know, here in Mexico, probably everyone hears or knows the names of the huge, you know, the leaders of the drug cartels, and they're kind of like celebrities. You know, everyone knows them and knows their name, where they're from, and it's easy to know who they are. But all of those drugs, or most of them, go to the U.S., right? Because the U.S., it's like the biggest drug consumer. So why do you think nobody knows who's the person receiving all of them, you know? Like, in here, it's so public. Like, everyone knows.
Excellent question.
And over there, no one knows anything. Like, I've never heard of anyone receiving all that stuff, you know? What do you think about that?
I'm completely in the dark what's happening now, and so your question is an excellent one. I mean, I'm trying to know, and I don't know. I do know a fair amount about the drug trade now, back in the eras of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and maybe even 80s. And it was very striking, for example, that the marginal people in New Orleans or Chicago, those names were known, particularly if they got killed. Then there was a lot said about them. But that there was one man in Washington who was a top mob figure who had political connections. He had drug connections. He was an international drug trafficker, or part of a network of drug traffickers. His name was Joe Nesline, N-E-S-L-I-N-E, and almost nobody had heard about him, even though the more important, the general picture was, the more important the trafficker, the less you knew about him. So I'm sort of agreeing with you that there is the secrecy here protects the drug trade itself. And I do believe this is because of the forbidden topic, that the CIA has used drug traffickers in the conduct of its parapolitics in many parts of the world, including Mexico, but not limited to Mexico. Southeast Asia, Africa, certainly the Middle East, Lebanon, and Italy, and France. So it's a global phenomenon. China, Thailand, Burma. It's all over the place. The more I would have trouble naming to you a significant CIA covert operation that didn't involve drugs. So that's how profoundly it is part of American foreign policy, the dark side of American foreign policy.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, my question is, you know, considering that the U.S. has already some presence here in Mexico through the Marry the Plan and all that, would you think that we're facing basically a sovereignty versus security situation here?
Yes. You know, you've probably thought about this more than I have, but I think that the result of having the powerful drug gangs in Mexico is to create a situation where Mexico is less autonomous and more dependent on U.S. aid. And I think probably there are people in Washington who like it that way, just as the same would be, say, in Colombia, that you have the FARC in Colombia. And so Colombia wants, you know, there's a special plan that America has. I don't know how much these things are articulated as a conscious policy, and I'm not sure you would ever find it in writing. But I do think that when America is formulating its policies on drugs or anything else, it suits their purposes to have other governments that are not fully sovereign and fully independent of the United States. There was a very famous case, which is not in my book chapter because the facts are disputed, but I believe them. There was a point when the French mafia, the Corsican mafia from France, was powerful in the drug trade in Mexico. And then in 1972, there were a series of murders. And the Mexican drug trade for a while was dominated by a Cuban from Miami called Alberto Sicilia Falcón. And he had a close man working with him called José Egozi, who was a veteran of the CIA's army at the Bay of Pigs. He was a CIA man, the number two. And a German newspaper published an interview with Cecilia Falcone in which they charge, and I believe this, that one of the things that Cecilia was doing for the CIA was selling drugs and arms to insurrection groups in Central America, because this made these governments in Central America more eager to ask for U.S. military aid and alliance to deal with those armies. This, I don't normally deal with single source stories, so I didn't put that one in my book, but it fits a pattern that I've seen. There were Mexican agents too who were accused by, again, a single source, of training insurrectionaries on their ranches right in Mexico. That would, again, be the same pattern as what was alleged about Alberto Cecilia Falcone. America is increasing its own power by, shall we say, breaking up and diminishing the ability of a very powerful neighbor. Mexico is a major country in the world, but it doesn't have full control over its own country. I actually don't believe in the idea of sovereignty. I don't believe the American government has full control over the United States either, but it certainly has close to 90-95% control, whereas Mexico is seriously weakened by the presence of the drugs. I mean, Lebanon is the same thing, but I think it suited America to have a weak Lebanon because they were frightened of that a strong Lebanon might have been more powerfully anti-American. So, and I could give other examples from other parts of the world. So I think that was a very good question. And by the way, I want to congratulate all of you on your excellent English. I only wish I could speak Spanish as well as you speak English. So thank you for that.
Yeah. If you could just briefly perhaps touch on the topic of the creation of the DFS, which has wreaked havoc, as you've detailed, here in Mexico.
Yeah, but that's going back to the 1940s, right after World War II, and the instead of the great fear in America being of Nazism and Hitler, now the great fear was of Stalin and communism, and you had a quite powerful left in Mexico. And this America, we're not saying CIA here, we're saying America did the same thing in Mexico that it did in other parts of the world, certainly very much so in Europe, assisted the Mexicans to create an agency which was given the name Dirección Federal de Seguridad, but which was targeting in principally the left, but not just the communists, but also trade unions, workers who were striking and so on. This was done by the FBI because it wasn't a CIA yet. It actually happened in the same year that the CIA was created, 1947, but the CIA didn't get a covert capacity till a year later, and it didn't open an office in Mexico until 1949. And that's when E. Howard Hunt turned up in Mexico. And from the beginning, they knew that the people I think that the politician who worked on this was himself involved in drugs, and that he turned to the drug traffic for assets to build up this agency. And there was a military attaché in the U.S. Embassy who reported this and said, this is a bad thing. But then the CIA came in and said, well, the DFS has these connections with, it's clear they have these connections with the drug traffic, but they're the best of the security agencies, and so we should work with them. And it's interesting that Howard Hunt was in the agency at that time because he was a man with a history of working with drug traffickers. He had already done it in China, and he came to Mexico with some degree of knowledge about the Kuomintang in China, And at that stage, the Kuomintang, the Chinese in Mexico, were still very prominent in the drug traffic. So I can't conclusively prove that Hunt came down to consolidate that drug connection, but it's very suggestive, and it's very interesting that that's a period when Corsican drug traffickers from France, who enjoyed a CIA connection over in France, came and started trafficking drugs in Mexico with impunity. They had what we call a roof or protection, and I think the DFS and the CIA together were supplying it as far back as 1949. And of course, it grew. The DFS protection grew stronger and stronger, and the DFS grew stronger and stronger because the CIA was controlling Mexican government through the DFS. And a lot of the people who became actual CIA agents, that is to say Mexican politicians on the CIA payroll, those people got promoted to be the head of the DFS, and then more than one of them went on to be the minister of the Gobernación, and after that to be the president of Mexico. And more than one of those presidents would then have a brother or a brother-in-law or a nephew or something who was the contact to the drug trade in Mexico. So the whole drug traffic was getting a kind of protection which had to do with this CIA interest in controlling, being, first of all, it wasn't so much directly to control Mexico as to make sure that there was no left wing in Mexico. But the whole history of Mexico was of a left-wing government that had nationalized the oil industry. And after 40 or 50 years of the CIA presence and the FBI presence didn't go away, that you see that the everything got privatized. And when, particularly when Salinas did a major privatization to come more into line with the Washington idea of free enterprise, the people who were able to buy the big industries, more than one of them, were people who did it with their profits from the drug trade. So I feel America has a very high degree of responsibility for what is described in our newspapers as being Mexico's drug problem.
Our class was canceled 2 weeks ago due to over a dozen narco blockades. One bus driver was burned to death. And how might you best explain the reasons for this violence? Is it that these deep forces that want to assure that certain cartels that are allied with them come out on top? Or how might you best explain some of this violence that's going on?
Well, I'm not in a position to give a detailed analysis of what happened 2 weeks ago, but the general situation has been that you have different cartels, in part because you have different political organizations, and each of them gets strong with its own protection. When Salinas came to power, that was a good moment for the Gulf Cartel. I don't know what the present situation is with Las Zetas and Sinaloa Cartel. These go up and these go down, but there's usually an inside track. And of course, when that happens, the result, if there's one cartel going up and another going down, the result is violence. And the violence tends to get concentrated in places like Ciudad Juarez, for example, across from El Paso, where it's on the border between the two cartels, and so they're fighting it out there. Unfortunately, I can't tell you what exactly happened in your city because I'm not up to the minute with what's happening in Mexico. I've been studying Afghanistan for the last 10 years now, really.
Okay. Any final question for Dr. Scott? Carolina.
Hello. Before leaving, can you tell us some recommendations for us as future graduates in international relations? In what kind of things or actions can we take to try to eradicate this drug issue we're now facing?
Well, I don't know what possibility there is for normalization. I have seen a couple of news stories about Mexico where people in Mexico are beginning to say that this, the idea of just going out and fighting, using the army to fight the cartels, has not been productive. What is it, 47,000 people have been killed? This is terrible. And that maybe it is time to think of normalization and decriminalization. You understand the difference between legalization, the government loses control of how the drug is trafficked. Decriminalization is that you stop treating drug offenses as being crimes, and you allow, the way they do it in Portugal is very good. In Portugal, the government, if you have drug addicts, the government supplies the drugs. So that means that the mobs, the organized crime, has lost control of the traffic. So I think that this decriminalization is something which my recommendation to you specifically would be, I think Mexicans should study what is being done in Europe to normalize the trade. I think the two best examples are Portugal and the Netherlands. I'm actually in a film called Raw Opium, which has about 20 minutes of a very detailed, close-in look at what's happening in Portugal. I think to get those kind of films and look at them, and there's a literature coming up. There's not much of it in English because America is very opposed to what Portugal is doing, which I think is a sign of just how sick the American approach is. It's clearly a better approach in Portugal, and therefore the DEA is lying about it. And one of the big items in the DEA budget is to fight people like me who are advocating decriminalization. So they're trying to control thoughts of people in this country, which is not what the American government is supposed to be doing by the Constitution. So that's my recommendation, that you look at the alternatives and see if they could be applicable to Mexico and if they could be made a political issue in Mexico. That would be my recommendation.
And any final comments or thoughts or advice to students and other educators?
Well, I want to commend you for having your interest in this topic, and go ahead and get yourself located in society and then see if you can do something to... there are people all over the world who in one way or another are trying to make this a more peaceful and happier world, and I believe that better knowledge of how the world is working now is one of the ways we'll get there. And so that students have a special responsibility, and I wish you all great careers. And I apologize. I speak French. I speak some other languages. But coming from Canada, I was never exposed to Spanish. And so even if I say adios, you'll probably laugh at the way I say it. But I've enjoyed talking to you, and thank you very much.
Okay, I hope this inspires a new generation of truth seekers. And what's the best way to support you and your work?
Buy my books.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hasta la vista.